In Sri Aurobindo's epic poem, Savitri, he uses the characters to tell the story of his yoga practice and the mother's yoga practice. The king, King Asupati, gives us the whole process of Sri Aurobindo's yoga in his inward journeys. And the goal of the king is to find the Divine Mother and to ask her to come back and help the earth. She does this. She promises him that she will take birth as his own daughter, Savitri. And in the story of Savitri, Sri Aurobindo tells us about the mother and the mother's yoga. We're going to start with Book 7, the Book of Yoga. At this point, Savitri has gone through the world to find her mate and found him. He is the son of a king who has lost his kingdom, and he's been brought up in a rude hermitage in the forest. She has returned to her parents and told them that she has found her mate. At the same time, the great sage Narad is visiting her parents, and Narad tells her that Sachivan is indeed the highest perfection, the flowering of humanity, but he is too good. And so in 1 year, he's going to die. Savitri refuses to find another mate. She has chosen Sachivan, and she won't choose again. And so with the beginning of Book 7, Savitri is returning for her marriage. We're going to read the first half of Canto 1. And Canto 1 is the joy of union, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death, and the heart's grief and pain. Fate followed her foreseen immutable road. Man's hopes and longings build the journeying wheels that bear the body of his destiny and lead his blind will towards an unknown goal. His fate within him shapes his acts and rules. Its face and form already are born in him. Its parentage is in his secret soul. Here, matter seems to mold the body's life, and the soul follows where its nature drives. Nature and fate compel his free will's choice, but greater spirits this balance can reverse and make the soul the artist of its fate. This is the mystic truth our ignorance hides. Doom is a passage for our inborn force. Our ordeal is the hidden spirit's decree. All was fulfilled. The heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen. And on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. Once more, she sat behind loud hastening hooves, a speed of armored squadrons, and a voice far heard of chariots bore her from her home. A couchant earth wakened in its dumb muse, looked up at her from a vast indolence, hills wallowing in a bright haze, large lands that lolled at ease beneath the summer heavens, region on region, spacious in the sun, cities like chrysolites in the wide blaze, and yellow rivers pacing, lion-maned, led to the Shalwa March's emerald line, a happy front to iron vastnesses and austere peaks and Titan solitudes. Once more was near the fair and fated place, the borders gleaming with the grove's delight, where first she met the face of Satyavan, and he saw, like one waking into a dream, some timeless beauty and reality, the moon-gold sweetness of heaven's earth-born child. The past receded, and the future neared. Far now behind lay Madra's spacious halls, the white-carved pillars, the cool, dim alcoves, the tinged mosaic of the crystal floors, the towered pavilions, the wind-rippled pools, the gardens humming with the murmur of bees. Forgotten soon, or a pale memory, the fountains plash in the white stone-bound pool, the thoughtful noontime's brooding solemn trance. The colonnades dream, gray in the quiet eve, the slow moonrise gliding in front of night. Left far behind now were the faces known, the happy silken babble on laughter's lips, and the close clinging clasp of intimate hands, and adoration's light in cherished eyes offered to the one sovereign of their life. Nature's primeval loneliness was here. Here only was the voice of bird and beast, the ascetic's exile in the dim-souled, huge, inhuman forest, far from cheerful sound of man's blithe converse and his crowded days. In a broad eve, with one red eye of cloud, through a narrow opening, a green-flowered cleft, out of the stare of sky and soil, they came into a mighty home of emerald dusk. There, onward led by a faint brooding path which toiled through the shadow of enormous trunks and under arches misers of sunshine, they saw low thatched roofs of a hermitage huddled beneath a patch of azure hue in a sunlit clearing that seemed the outbreak of a glad smile in the forest's monstrous heart. A rude refuge of the thought and will of man, watched by the crowded giants of the wood. Arrived in that rough-hewn homestead, they gave, questioning no more the strangeness of her fate, their pride and loved one, to the great blind king, a regal pillar of fallen mightiness. And the stately, careworn woman, once a queen, who now hoped nothing for herself from life, but all things only hoped for her one child, calling on that single head from partial fate, all joy of earth, all heaven's beatitude. Adoring wisdom and beauty like a young god's, she saw him loved by heaven, as by herself. She rejoiced in his brightness and believed in his fate, and knew not of the evil drawing near. Lingering for some days upon the forest verge, like men who lengthen out departure's pain, unwilling to separate sorrowful clinging hands, unwilling to see for the last time a face, heavy with the sorrow of a coming day, and wondering at the carelessness of fate who breaks with idle hands her supreme works, they parted from her with pain-fraught, burdened hearts, as forced by inescapable fate we part from one whom we shall never see again. Driven by the singularity of her fate, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart, they left her to her rapture and her doom in the tremendous forest's savage charge. All put behind that once was her life, all welcomed that henceforth was his and hers, she abode with Satyavan in the wild woods. Priceless she deemed her joy so close to death. Apart with love, she lived for love alone. As if self-poised above the march of days, her immobile spirit watched the haste of time, a statue of passion and invincible force, an absolutism of sweet, imperious will, a tranquility and a violence of the gods, indomitable and immutable. At first, to her, beneath the sapphire heavens, the sylvan solitude was a gorgeous dream, an altar of the summer's splendor and fire, a sky-topped, flower-hung palace of the gods, and all its scenes, a smile on rapture's lips, and all its voices, bards of happiness. There was a chanting in the casual wind. There was a glory in the least sunbeam. Night was a chrysoprase on velvet cloth, a nestling darkness, or a moonlit deep. Day was a purple pageant and a hymn, a wave of the laughter of light from morn to eve. His absence was a dream of memory. His presence was the empire of a god, a fusing of the joys of earth and heaven, a tremulous blaze of nuptial rapture past, a rushing of two spirits to be one, a burning of two bodies in one flame. Opened were gates of unforgettable bliss. Two lives were locked within an earthly heaven, and fate and grief fled from that fiery hour. But soon now failed the summer's ardent breath, and throngs of blue-black clouds crept through the sky, and rain fled sobbing over the dripping leaves, and storm became the forest's tightened voice. Then, listening to the thunder's fatal crash and the fugitive pattering footsteps of the showers and the long unsatisfied panting of the wind and sorrow muttering in the sound-vexed night, the grief of all the world came near to her. Night's darkness seemed her future's ominous face. The shadow of her lover's doom arose, and fear laid hands upon her mortal heart.